what I was going to do, this is side two of Patrick Guide Lecture 73, the repulsion to recreate and overcome childhood hurt. So what I'm going to use as an example is, in the first half I talked about a child feeling abandoned. Now, if that child takes that in, and because of their mix of task and spirit and 10,000 other factors, decides that there is no hope, then that child can go through life believing, I will never get my needs met. But people don't go through life simply saying, I won't get any, that's okay, I don't care. That's just not human nature. So what's going to happen is there's going to at some point be some protest about that. There's going to be a sense of feeling fed up and wanting to get your share of what is available. Now, if I mix in spiritual law with this, number one, you were not actually abandoned. You were invited by the parent that you chose to allow the fact that you believe there is abandonment to come to the surface. So I'm going to start over and go in a different direction and show you how vastly different this could be. So in the first case, the child feels abandoned and it tries to resign, it tries to not care, it tries to just put up with crumbs on the table. But I've never met anybody that really believes that 24/7 the rest of their life. Okay, so there's a dynamic that starts there based on a belief in abandonment. If you go back from a spiritual perspective, the parent chosen because they could not meet all your needs has in effect given you this experience, because that belief that there won't be enough for me was already in you. That is one of your distortions. What principle, what spiritual law does that break? I didn't bring the list. I don't have it in front of me. But let's say it breaks the law of brotherhood. And by that I mean it can't be real. In the law of brotherhood, we are all children of God. We are all divine beings. We are all equally important. We may not be as equally developed, but we're equally important in the universe. And the law of brotherhood says there is no abandonment. You're surrounded by angels. You're surrounded by spirits. We brought you here with love so you could learn that this feeling that it is possible to be abandoned cannot be true. And as you go on your life, perhaps the learning in that case would be, I do have enough. I don't mean to make light of this, but that's why little snippets of culture really stick in our minds. And what just came to me at that moment was Dorothy clicking her heels and saying, there's no place like home. There's a reason that movie was so popular. There's a place in us that knows that the answer is inside. And as we go around trying to create it on the outside, we're, in effect, to some degree, wasting our time. And if you look at almost, I haven't looked at every civilization, but I've looked at a lot of them, and they're all saying the same thing. There's no place like home. Love is in your heart. And you create based on what you're willing to create. And it's a cultural belief system that I believe goes back to the people knowing spiritual truth and then having to deal with the craziness of reality, which argues with you. Now I'm going to go back to the abandonment. Child's in the crib, same thing, but this child has a different task and a different distortion. So this child doesn't get its needs met, and it says, how do I get my needs met? And I remember an interview with Robin Williams, and they said, how did you develop this rapid-fire, never-stop, insane ability to to generate all this humor. And he said he used to entertain his mother because she was ill. And from that desire to be to be loving, to be a support for, to take a loved one's mind off their pain, from that place came a development of skill, a place where his mind, like little mushrooms, grew places to put all this ability to be creative and funny and fascinating, that he was later able to turn into foundation stone for his later success. So a child that feels abandoned and feels like, if I just did this or I just did that, will go into an activity of some type with a lot more zest and enthusiasm, because what's really happening is they think that their life is at stake. I have to be smart. And what a child will do is it will find some place where it can excel or be seen or bring recognition. Now, you can feel this splitting off into several areas. It will also be a place where, if a child has no positive place to put its energy, it will put its energy into negativity. It will act out. It will become a rebel, a juvenile delinquent, a problem. Because human nature is, we need to be looked at. We need to be talked to. We need to matter, even if that attention is negative. At least it's something. But just from that one tiny example, perhaps you can see where, depending on the distortion that the soul is trying to resolve and the situation that it has created for itself, you can go off in millions of directions given the same circumstances with the same parents. And the reason it is specifically unique is we don't always know the forcing current, the compelling force in that spirit, and what it needs to both manifest and resolve. So if we take the title of this lecture, which I'm not saying it's negative, I love the title of this lecture, but there, it tends to use words that we can give negative context to. So the compulsion to recreate and overcome childhood hurt. The positive aspect of that is the divine force compels us to get this, no matter how many times it takes, no matter how much effort it takes. We need to see our distortion, meet it face to face, hold it right up next to us, to feel the pain and experience where this is not a solution, until the day we are able and willing to truly, without being in mask, to truly relax and let go. A longer sentence than compulsion to recreate and overcome childhood hurt, but that's why I love the title. It says it quite well. So from a spiritual perspective, the distortions that we create in terms of being in the wrong place, and by wrong place I mean we're in a place that is not in our best interest, but we have decided that we can succeed here and success is important. Success is more important than happiness. That's a distortion. If we choose someone for qualities that are superficial because we need to look good, that's a distortion. You don't want to be with somebody just because they have artificial qualities that other people admire. Okay. There are too many examples for me to list here of all the ways where we may reach out to someone and not be in truth about that person, but actually be in the grip of a childhood compulsion that we need to resolve. And what we're basically saying, if we enter a relationship in distortion, not always that way, but if we enter a relationship in distortion, this is one of the key places to look. That by looking at the childhood hurt, the places where we did not feel we were met, where we were not seen, where we did not have the opportunity to to be divinely beautiful the way we naturally are. That all those things don't fade away. They simply go underground. And then they begin to resurface as we walk through life. So perhaps you can understand that I spent a lot of time trying to put this in context, because the simple fact that you marry your mother is just not very juicy. It's edible, it's interesting, people do that all the time. But to understand the deeper significance of that, that's where the guide says in a later lecture, when he talks about the relationship between man and woman, he talks about marriage and divorce, and he says you need to understand why you are where you are. Because if you don't understand what you've done, you're going to repeat it. So this is the common phrase of, if you do not understand history, you are destined to repeat it. And the spiritual reality inside that is that this compulsion is divine. This need, this task that we have assigned ourselves is the most important thing we have to do. And until we meet it and resolve it, we will be driven by it. Now, one of the things about spirituality is that, sometimes I feel like, just read the lectures. It's all in there. But where I can perhaps be helpful sometimes is I've read a large portion of them. And it's hard to know where to read and what to find. And so what I'm trying to do in these teleconferences is I'm trying to encourage you to read the lectures. But if you read one that's not relevant to you, it can be a little dry and dusty and leave a bad taste in your mouth, and you might walk away. So I'm trying to bring in context that I have learned that helped me to understand the depth of this lecture. So in another lecture on New Age marriage and man and woman, the guide talks about divorce and says, yes, sometimes that is appropriate. There are no right and wrongs. There are no absolutes. Yes, sometimes that is not appropriate. But the question to be asked is this. There was a reason for the relationship. If you simply terminate the relationship and you have not found the underlying forces that caused you to link up with someone who is truly not appropriate for you in your stage of development, then you will naturally lumber on and perhaps do it again. So there's a 12-step phrase, which is useful here, and that is never let yourself get too hungry or too tired or too desperate, because when you're in a situation of great need, you lose your sense of discernment. You'll eat junk food. You'll be with an inappropriate person because the loneliness or the hunger or the pain of where you are is so great that you need immediate relief, and you may not be as careful as you might be. So if you've gotten into a relationship out of some level of desperation, that may be true. It may be an inappropriate relationship. It may not be a relationship that can flower. But the work that we do in Pathwork Process, if you look at where were you, how did you get to a place where you would make a choice like that? How did you not see the signs coming? What are you ignorant of about your nature? What are you in denial of, or what are you unconscious about, that you would not see this train wreck coming? The second question to ask is this person inappropriate? Or perhaps you are not willing to do what it takes to meet this person. So again, from a divine standpoint, every person you meet is perfect, if you knew what the task was. And to walk away from a relationship because it doesn't suit you or does not seem to serve you may mean that you'll have to do that numerous times because you're looking for the wrong thing. And what Patrick invites you to do, what the lecture on relationship invites you to do, is to pause. Just pause. Breathe. And see if you can now see forcing currents in you that you may not have seen 6 months ago, a year ago, 10 years ago. That a place of pain, as in any breakup of a relationship, brings to the surface things that may not have been apparent before. So it's a little bit like detoxing, okay, or literally vomiting up. You may not have seen it before, but now it's all out there on the table, your behavior, your inability to communicate, your resentment. There's a lot on the table, and it doesn't all belong to the other party in the relationship in general. Some things belong to that person, but not everything. And if you can pause there and reflect and go through different dynamics in the relationship and try to have a clearer understanding of where you were coming from, were you coming from distortion or were you coming from a very clear and enlightened place? Why would a clear and enlightened person take up with somebody who isn't clear and enlightened? Maybe you wanted to help. That's great. But did the other party have an equal desire to be helped? Or are you working on a forcing current from childhood where you gave yourself a sense of purpose by helping? And that may cloud your judgment, and you may not see where the other person is not as committed to being helped as you are to helping. I speak this from trying to find a positive place in both parties where they are enacting their spiritual task and they have become magnetized together. And if they pull apart and don't look at the situation carefully, they'll just magnetize back into another relationship without having resolved it. But in the place where you realize, where awareness has come, I am in a dysfunctional situation, and you put it all on the table and you look at it, then there's a possibility that you could have been looking at things from a skewed perspective. And if you shift your perspective around, you may be able to see something from a different angle. You may be able to learn something about yourself. You may be able to learn something about the currents that have moved in your life, because your relationship is not the only place this is going to show up. If you take the idea of marrying your mother, and you, in effect, your profession mirrors that same thing. If your mother was a strong person who believed that you must go out and help the community, and you grow up and you become a community worker, is that completely you? Or is that a desire to manifest your mom's value? That's not a bad thing. That's a great thing. And that's a powerful motivating force. Unless that's not what you want to do. What if you'd rather be a research scientist? And what if, in being a research scientist, you could find a depth of inner peace that would enable you to go through your spiritual path like a hot knife through butter? So as long as you're a community organizer, you're not doing that. You're involved with people, and there's a lot of details, and there's a lot of politics, and there's a lot of going out and talking to people, a lot of activity that could, in this example, that could prevent you from coming to a place of inner stillness and seeing what you need to see. And that's where sometimes following this so-called good life, this so-called good choice, actually is an attempt to run away from the task that some part of our being knows we're supposed to engage with. And sometimes you go there and then you circle back. So there is no right or wrong. What I'm talking about is a place where when you come to a realization that you are in a dysfunctional situation of whatever kind, in whatever level of relationship you can invent. Work, family, home, society, relationship with your cat, it doesn't matter. I remember one time I had a cat that after 4 or 5 years, the sad fact was she didn't like me. She wasn't getting her needs met. I was not affectionate enough. And I realized that I had it with having to pet this cat day and night at her command. We simply weren't suited. Now, that may sound trivial to some people, but for pet owners, perhaps some of you can empathize with this. I wound up adopting her out. And it was, went through a lot of emotions in that because it's wrong and you're not supposed to. And I have a lot of pet lovers and cat lovers. And even if they didn't say, we think you're wrong, they were shocked that I would adopt out a cat that I'd had for so many years. But the truth is, we weren't suited to each other. And in this particular story, I didn't lock her out of the house. I didn't send her to the pound. I didn't kill her. We found an adoptive home for her, and I have a friend of mine who checks in once in a while. Cat is as happy as she can be, wound up with a little old lady who has nothing to do day and night but pet her. She is in heaven. And the truth is, I was not suited for a pet that needed that much attention. Now, I'm not trying to be childish about this, but the truth is, in human relationships, we have competing needs, and we have different things that we want from each other. And sometimes the match doesn't work. In my process with the cat, because I'm a pathwork helper, I looked at the pathwork principles. I looked at a lot of spiritual stuff about brotherhood. I went down the list with the cat because it's just another manifestation. And there was a place where I tried to be more affectionate to her, thinking it was me. Perhaps I withhold. Perhaps I don't give enough of myself. Perhaps it would do me some good to do some cat petting right now instead of working on work. But over time, that wasn't the answer. Cat had a personality, and she needed a different owner. So that's about all I needed to present myself. If anybody has any questions, number one, you're always welcome to ask, to interrupt and ask. I have no problem with that. You're welcome to now if you'd like.
Jan, would you mind spending a minute talking about the connection between the perceived unrequited parental love that a child has with what's perceived as unrequited eros love and sexuality in an adult?
Okay, I hear your question, but I did one version of that, so I'm going to guess that I didn't give you what you needed. So, without asking for details, can you ask that question again from a more personal point of view? Just generic.
Well, the idea of the the current of Eros being recognized as an initial kind of strong feeling, and then if that's not requited, I suppose the usual thought of how that is requited is through sexual activity.
Okay.
But it's obviously not complete as love, but the idea of transformation of Eros into love, I suppose, is what that is. And then it seemed to me that as a child, the unrequited parental love might have something to do with that confusion.
Okay, that's great. Thank you so much, because I have a much better idea now of what you were looking for. So one of my ahas when you're asking the question, and I'm check with me, because if I'm not answering your question. Call me on it. I hear in part of your question whether eros can be wrong.
And I hadn't thought about that, but that I guess that's a way of putting it, yes.
Yes. So I did the teleconference on soul movements and talked about eros at that time. And maybe there's 50, but one of the key lectures in Pathwork is lecture 44, The Forces of Love, Eros, and Sexuality. So that's a good one. But in answer to your question, my perception is that eros is never wrong. But eros can get you in a lot of trouble. Now, there's a difference, and I want to speak to that. The difference between human perception and spiritual perception is eros is talked of as a full movement. We're not talking about erotic, which is a forcing current. Talking about eros, we're talking about the place where your heart leaps across the room. From a spiritual perspective, your heart leaps across the room because that woman has the potential to help you work on your distortion. Now, that can come from, she can help me by making me feel pleasure, and I will open my heart. But it can also come from a desire to open your heart in a certain way, and Eros says, okay, that'll do it. But opening your heart in a certain way is not a full-throttled surrender to relationships. So what I'm describing is that eros is a desire to get on with the spiritual task. Soul movement, let's do another chapter. And from that perspective, eros can never be wrong.
So Jan, hello, it's Andrea here. Are you saying that really the key to it is to have consciousness around it? So to have consciousness around the eros and why we're drawn to this person, and not looking at that person as they're the answer to our, they're going to give us what we didn't have, but kind of learning to tolerate what comes up and our unconscious demand on that person to be the perfect person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So your eros can lead you down some roads that are painful and difficult. But from a perspective, so what? You may need to go down those roads.
Yeah.
And your eros knows it. So I think of eros having one of those feet that just cannot be controlled, and you've got the puppy sitting on your lap, and the next thing you know, it's across the room, and it's on the lap of somebody who's 20 years younger than you. And you're going, oh, my God, you know. I know I like that person, I know I was attracted to that person, but I would never have let on that I was attracted to that person. But the puppy is over there. That's what eros can feel like. It is spontaneous. It is free. It goes wherever it wants to go. Well, that may or may not be about that person. That might be about eros saying, honey, we need to be around other people. We need a relationship. Stop judging everybody and let's be more open because I need to live. I need to breathe. Eros is the voice saying, life, where's life? I want to live. Where's pleasure? I want pleasure. Where's righteousness? Where's righteousness in the best sense of the word? Where is divinity? Where is my next opportunity to grow? That's what eros can tell us. But when the eros does that, it's like a child. You don't let a child choose your outfit for the day. It can suggest. But there are other elements that come into play. So I gave an example in another teleconference of when you walk, and I know this is a girl example, but I'm a girl, so there you go. You walk by a shop window, and you see a red, you are attracted to that red dress. Go in and you buy it, but of course it doesn't look good on you and it sits in your closet. What is that about? Well, the eros was telling you, we want more femininity. We want more feminine energy in our lives. That would do it. That's one way to do it. Eros does not demand that you do that particular activity or what it is specifically pointing you towards. So if we think of Eros as an indicator of flow that wants to occur, then we use our intelligence, we use our ego, we use all the other capacities we have as people to say, is that the specific best answer? Or can I broaden my view and see a lot of options here?
Jen?
Yes.
Okay, now I have two questions. When Harold was asking his question, this one...
Question.
I'm sorry?
Okay, and I'm open to whatever you want to say.
I'm sorry, I missed what you said?
Well, I'm personally bookmarking that I have one more part to answer, but this may help me, so please go ahead.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry, I thought you had finished.
No, that's okay, go ahead.
Okay, well, when Harold was asking his question, the question that came into my head, and I'm not going to, because I don't have a psychology background, so I may state this wrong, but there's something, the Oedipal complex, mm-hmm. Oedipal, isn't that right, where you fall in love, you are romantically in love with one of your parents, and so I don't know if this is what he was getting at it or not, but this is what popped in my head as he was asking his question. And so, you know, because when he said unrequited love, well, you know, that's not realistic, right? And again, I don't have a psychology background, but my understanding of the Oedipal complex is that, you know, that it's not realistic, but you're jealous of the same-sex parent because they've stolen this person you're in love with, right? Isn't that how it goes?
Yeah. And
okay.
That's going to lead me right back into answering Harry's question. So,
Okay.
So here's how those two parts come together. In terms of spirituality and psychology, where they meet is that the Oedipal stage is a natural stage of development in a human being. That's the place where we are seeing that we as girls or we as boys are going to behave in a certain way in society. But we're still little. So girls should marry men. I have a great idea. My daddy's the best man I know. That's the actual psychological origin of the Oedipal complex. It's a natural phase. And the intention is that we will move through that. But that at that point, what the little girl is saying is, I'm a girl. Girls marry men. I'm just picking this. I know that there are other solutions, and I'm more than happy, but you can't put every example into one analogy. I see the model that society is showing me, and this would work because I like my dad. And, oh, I can already see it coming. There she is. There's my rival. The positive of that is the child is already getting a whiff of the dynamics that occur in human existence. From a very immature place, from a very tiny place. But the positive is, that's like playing with dolls. That's how we learn. And we're meant to move through that. Same thing for the boys. They see mom and they see men and they say, oh, I will go to work and I will get married and I will have babies and mom would be, I love my mother, that'd be a great choice. Whoa, now what do I do with my father who's physical and I'm little? How do I survive in this world? There's a real positive there for a little boy, trying to figure out how does this fit together? And just like playing soldier or playing football captain or all the games that little children play, we play these games and we're acting out what we see. We're trying to iron out, we're trying to resolve the incredible amount of information that we're being handed as human beings. We're trying to make some sense of the situation. And as children, what we do is we gravitate towards simplistic answers because we don't have the tools to handle a more complex answer. So if you're asking, is this lecture about the Oedipal complex? Not particularly. Okay? But an Oedipal complex that gets shamed or overly encouraged in the wrong direction is part of a childhood hurt. That's where a child is not being served properly by its parents. When the father actually shoves away any adoration that his daughter gives him, she feels like she's done something wrong. that can grow into a distortion. If a parent grabs that innocent, wonderful childhood love and says, yes, I love it and I want it. I want all of it. You make me feel special. Your father doesn't. That's also going to feed a distortion. And the child, that's not a good situation, and there will be consequences, and the child will get hurt. The child does not have the tools to enact complex social situations. And the child does not know what it's triggering in those two adults. So that's where the Oedipal stuff kind of fits in on a different level. Now, if I go back to the question that I kind of ran off with, Carrie was asking about sexuality. I love Lecture 44 on love, eros, and sex because of how it speaks about eros, making it wonderful and gentle and a guide to what you should be doing instead of something that you need to control. I also love it because it talks about sexuality, and so does Lecture 207, which is the spiritual significance of sexuality. The guide speaks of sexuality as one manifestation of the life force. And in human culture, because we are throttled a little bit, human culture across the board has something to say about sexuality of its members. It may say go for it, or it may say don't go for it, but it has something to say. And an individual may not get served, no matter how generous or loving a society is, just like an individual may not get served, no matter how wonderful its parents are. Okay, or it may fit in beautifully, depends on the situation. But society has something to say about sexuality precisely because sexuality is such a potent manifestation of life force. Society needs to keep this manifestation of life force in a specific channel. It needs to keep this force from jumping the banks and flooding the town and breaking rules and laws. Yes. I thought I heard a question. Didn't hear a question. Okay. So if sexuality is a primary channel for life force, basically what we have done is by entering into human life, we knew that. We knew that sexuality is powerful. We knew that it could channel an incredible amount of energy, that it would align with procreation and survival and hardwired instincts that are positive and have tremendous negative possibilities. Okay? So we are basically, when we engage with sexuality energetically or technically, we have a tiger by the tail. And what the lecture, what 44 suggests is that we both honor the sexual impulses, but we also bring them into a more spiritual context. Yes, we want pleasure. Yes, our bodies want sexual satisfaction. But human beings have built civilization based on, hang on a minute, relax, we're going to distract you for a bit, and then we're going to try to give you some opportunity. Human societies are built on structures so that the channel is allowed but is held. And societies, just like parents, don't do that perfectly. All these elements come together. So you have a compulsion to recreate, and that can start with an eros. The eros wasn't about doing it wrong again. The eros was about healing. Eros looks across the room and says, that person, that's it, that's the one. And you translated that as the perfect one, the best one, the most pleasurable experience. Your Eros knew a little bit more than you did and said, no, that's going to get us in terrible trouble. We're finally going to move through this block. Can you feel the difference between a wider, enlightened viewpoint and sometimes the simplistic interpretations that we give it, and also the selfish interpretations We don't want to get in trouble. There's a place when we talk about negativity that I feel isn't spoken about in a positive sense. And that is, we don't want to change. If you think you truly want to change, think again. And that by manifesting as human beings, we have gotten ourselves born into a universe that never stops. You can't stop growing. You can't stop living unless you die. You can't hit pause button. Okay? And that creates dynamics. And that reveals us in our distortions. We make mistakes. We make mistakes upon mistakes upon mistakes. And there's a positive quality to that. But there's also a place where we would really rather cement the planet and turn it into a parking lot so that we don't have to feel these chaotic feelings, so that we do not have to endure the pain of separation loss. Or we'd like to guarantee at least 2 hours of pleasure in the next 2 hours. Could I just have that? Just 2 hours. Okay? But behind that demand, you don't want 2 hours of pleasure. Nobody who really wants 2 hours of pleasure mandates that's what's going to happen. Someone who truly wants pleasure understands that there is pleasure in learning, pleasure in growth, pleasure in development. And that moment by moment, it may not feel good, but 30 years from now, you're going to be happy with your life. So what I'm saying here is that there needs to be an acknowledgement. It's in the lectures, and I believe it strongly. There needs to be an acknowledgement that we are resistant to change, that we are resistant to our own plan. So you've got a push-pull kind of thing. One of the things I carry, I have a little box that I carry and to workshop sometimes, and for years and years and years I carried one of those little silly Chinese finger pulls, you know, where when you're a kid you stick your fingers in and you can't get them out if you pull. That's what human life is like. And spirituality, and this is what you spoke of when you said, just breathe, just move with it. Spiritual life is about very slowly and carefully realizing that you're not trapped, that you're fine, that there is no great harm coming at you, or if there is harm, it's not going to kill you. And even if it's going to kill you, I wonder what this is all about. Now, please understand, I'm not saying that when the car comes at you, you stand in the street saying, maybe I'll die today. We'll see what happens. Because I can imagine that if you go upstairs and talk to your team, they would say, why didn't you get out of the way? And you say, I thought it would be fun. And they say, do you know how much work it took to get you down there in human form? Do you know what we're going to have to do? We're just going to have to do this again. Because, no, that was not the message. As a matter of fact, you cut the plan short. So the next time we make up a plan, we're going to change it so you can't do that. What I'm talking about is a place where when you find yourself in harm's way and you do what you have to do to get out of harm's way, it may cost you a broken leg. It may cost you, I really don't want to get into story, but there's a lot of permutations here. But the important thing is, you learned. How did you get in harm's way? Were you drunk? Were you stoned? Were you weeping so hard you couldn't see traffic? Or do you have a death wish? And translation of death wish would be, are you unwilling to do the work and secretly looking for a way out? Remember the game Chutes and Ladders? There are places of self-sabotage and suicide which are basically wanting to hit the reset button and saying, this is too hard, I can't do this. Now, it may be too hard. Keep in mind that you came up with this plan. And in this plan, you gave yourself absolutely everything you need to complete the plan. And what this lecture is about is another way of looking at what you gave yourself, your childhood experiences and your childhood hurts. Not the ones that are resolved. We don't work with the ones that are resolved. Those are fine. And we resolve phenomenal amount of process work. Children are astounding in their capacity to work through incongruities, to work through hypocrisy, to work through abandonment issues. And that's why if you put two children in exactly the same situation, you can have one child coming out saying, I never get what I want, and the other child coming out saying, I made it. I survived. Life is okay. Same situation. They come out with totally different points of view. So your hurt from childhood that remain with you in full adulthood have meaning. And you do need to resolve them. But if you're trying to resolve them by creating the battle again with other people and this time coming out victorious, that's not really dealing with the distortion. That's trying to win. And the idea that one person wins and the other person loses is a distortion. The unified look, the unified point of view there would be, yes, I need to heal myself. Yes, I need to work through my distortion. I wish to grow and transform, because when I do, I contribute to the positive influence in the universe. When I win, everyone wins. When someone else wins, I win. But on the planet, the first place trophy usually only goes to one person. So we're left with the illusion of losing, even though we might be the winner. Some of you might have experienced a teacher when you were little that basically awarded a grade or a prize or recognition to the child who tried hardest. Now, I was an A student, and I resented that because I worked hard for that A, and I didn't want any kid that tried hard to get extra credit. Until I was 14, and I was a pudgy, fat, clumsy, four-eyed intellectual kid, and when I was 14, I decided to make something of myself spiritually. Now, you can imagine this kid on the track. I came in so dead last, everybody else was in the showers by the time I finished the track. But my teacher gave me an A. Not for the year, for the semester. I couldn't go that far. And she gave me an A for the semester because she just couldn't help it. I tried so hard. She'd never seen anybody try so hard. But that didn't mean I had athletic ability. And that didn't mean that I could meet an objective standard. She just wanted to let me know that she'd seen me. And she gave me recognition that I really appreciated. And I certainly understood why she only gave me a B for the whole year, because you could only do so much with the body that you manifest. Perhaps on that silly note, are there any other questions right now?
Thanks, Jan.
No worries. Very grateful to have everyone here. The teleconference in 2 weeks is going to be on Lecture 160, The Conciliation of Inner Split. Now, I will tell you right now that I have not figured out yet why I picked that lecture. But somehow it goes with this one, and I was inspired to do that. I may bring in other lectures, because it may turn out that I can't get my head around that concept. But I wanted to pick some unjuicy lectures and show people the juice in them. So I took one that I knew was a great lecture that isn't normally taught or talked about, and I thought it would be fun to explore. So if you choose to join us then, you are welcome. Thanks very much for being here, and thank you so much for your questions, because that's what the work is about, your questions, your issues, not concepts. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jan.
Thank you,
Jan.
Thank you.